Before we start the show, just a reminder to share, like, and subscribe to this podcast wherever you're listening to it. And please, give us a 5-star rating. It helps us beat the big tech algorithm. Also, if you love Red Pilled America, please consider supporting the show. You can buy one of our 100% Made in America products because screw China. We have hats, candles, a book. That's right, we wrote a book. Or you can become a Backstage subscriber. Well, you'll have access to our entire archive, and you can hear the behind the scenes of each episode, along with Patrick and I arguing over who's a better storyteller. Or you can just make a donation. To support the show, please visit redpilledamerica.com and click support or shop in the top menu. That's redpilledamerica.com and click support or shop in the top menu. Support what you love or it goes away. Thanks, everyone.
No matter where you turn, you can't escape the phenomenon of wokeness. It has touched every facet of American culture.
Let's talk about wokeness coming to hockey.
49ers quarterback knelt instead of standing during the national anthem at last night's game.
And just like we've seen with nearly every other major sports organization, NASCAR has gone down the route of identity politics. They have gone woke.
Welcome, everyone, to a wonderful, brave new world of social accountability and political correctness in gaming.
Why aren't churches going woke?
It is everywhere you look. I don't think I've seen anything spread so fast in my life.
With it seeping into every nook and cranny of American culture at lightning speed, you have to wonder, where did wokeness come from? I'm Patrick Carelci.
And I'm Adriana Cortez.
And this is Red Pilled America, a storytelling show.
This is not another talk show covering the day's news. We are all about telling stories.
Stories Hollywood doesn't want you to hear.
Stories the media mocks. Stories about everyday Americans that the globalists ignore.
You could think of Red Pilled America as audio documentaries, and we promise only one thing. The truth.
Welcome to Red Pilled America.
Wokeness has seeped into every crevice of American culture. It's no longer just Hollywood, the media, and public schools who are infected. Wokeness has found its way into areas that were formerly untouchable by leftist ideology. Organizations like the National Hockey League and NASCAR have been touched by it. There's even woke pastors.
God is non-binary because God is the author of gender. God is genderless and genderful. God is queer because, like gender, God is the author of all sexualities. All sexualities exist in God, and yet God is not explicitly sexual. And since asexuality is part of the LGBTQ spectrum, we can say God is queer.
Wokeness has infected every influential institution in America. Social commentator Lauren Chen has a pretty good analogy for how this phenomenon has spread.
Now, I've pretty much started seeing wokeness, social justice, or cultural Marxism, whatever you want to call it, as the institutional equivalent of herpes. Because you see, it spreads very, very easily, and once you have it, you're pretty much stuck with it.
It's become so prevalent that funny man Michael Knowles has created a game based on wokeness.
Now I'm going to put my skills to the test. I'm going to get 100%. I'm going to bat 1,000 on guessing what product these woke commercials are selling.
With it seeming to be everywhere almost overnight, it's gotta make you wonder, where did wokeness come from? To find the answer, we tell the story of how an obscure group of German refugees started all of this madness, and what we need to do to stop it.
It was October 1918, and Germany was a financial and emotional wreck. After 4 years of conflict, the country was headed towards certain defeat in World War I and was stuck with paying damages to the winning side. Adding to their predicament, tension was brewing between the German nobility that decided to enter the war and the working class that were burdened with that decision. During the conflict, the German government made it mandatory to either fight on the battlefield or work to support the war effort, which meant long 12-hour shifts for low wages and less than adequate food. In the waning days of World War I, the German people were demoralized and angry. But even with this daunting road ahead, there was a segment of the German population that was strangely excited. almost enthusiastic about the coming misery. And that group were German Marxist intellectuals. They were enthusiastic because their dream of a communist revolution was about to become a reality. You see, Marxists at the time believed that communism was the inevitable result of capitalism. It was the primary tenet of their prophet Karl Marx. In their view, capitalism was exploitative. Once the working class, or proletariat as they called them, understood this true nature of capitalism, they would rise up and overthrow the system, heralding in Marxism. The failure of World War I looked like the trigger that would start Germany's inevitable communist revolution. And it wasn't such an outlandish belief at the time, because just 1,000 miles away from Germany, a communist revolution was indeed underway. About a year before the end of World War I, internal conflicts sprung up in Russia. Factions of the Russian army began a mutiny demanding a ceasefire. The unrest spread to the country's working class and rural farmers, who also wanted an end to the conflict, as well as some economic reforms. A grassroots faction of Marxists called the Bolsheviks would ultimately embark on an armed insurrection in the then Russian capital of Petrograd. They successfully overthrew the capitalist-aligned provisional government, then executed Russian Tsar Nicholas II and his family, moved the national capital to their stronghold of Moscow, and eventually brought together the different socialist factions all across the country to establish the Russian-Soviet Federative Socialist Republic. By doing so, they created the world's first socialist state, guided by a communist ideology. As this Russian Revolution kicked off in 1917, German Marxist intellectuals were not surprised. This was what Karl Marx predicted, and the situation in Germany a year later seemed to mirror that of Russia. There was economic ruin, misery, and a building tension between the German working class and the country's affluent. In the minds of the German Marxist intellectuals, the birthplace of their prophet appeared to be fertile ground for a socialist revolution. Well, almost like clockwork, by the end of October 1918, a communist uprising took hold in Germany. It started with a sailors' revolt that ignited a violent conflict throughout the country between the working class and capitalist-aligned factions. However, when it was all said and done roughly 9 months later, the German government took the form of a parliamentary system. The country's working class settled for a largely capitalist form of government. According to Marxist theory, this was not supposed to happen.
One of the foundational principles of Marxism at the time was that once the working class experienced the exploitative nature of capitalism, they would rise up and overthrow it. Karl Marx's disciples saw the contradiction of an affluent class living amongst the meager wage-earning general public as unsustainable. It would inevitably lead to communism. Germany's conditions perfectly fit the parameters for a socialist shift, but it didn't happen in Germany, or for that matter, in any countries throughout Western civilization. A foundational crisis gripped Marxism, and in 1922, a political science student named Felix Weyl organized the first Marxist Workweek conference to address the issue. A primary goal of the gathering was to figure out why Germany's revolution didn't lead to a socialist state. The conference was meant to be the first of several future meetings of Marxist intellectuals, but because of the success of the gathering, the attendees wanted to create something more permanent. So the event creator Felix Weyl approached his father, a wealthy grain merchant, and asked him for the funds to start a Marxist-influenced research institute. His father agreed. The founders then forged an agreement with a local university in Frankfurt, Germany, to house their endeavor. And in 1923, they launched the Institute of Social Research. Its first director was Karl Grunberg, a Marxist philosopher, professor of law, and economic historian. Even with its earlier ambitions, the Frankfurt School, as the institute would come to be known, started off pretty traditional. Director Grunberg had a bit of an orthodox approach to studying Marxism. He was not necessarily interested in modernizing its core principles. Instead, Grunberg focused more on studying Marxism scientifically as a system of economics expressed by Karl Marx in his foundational text Das Kapital. The early Frankfurt School research steered away from taking on the elephant in the room, namely, why the German Revolution didn't lead to the socialist state that Karl Marx predicted. But they wouldn't be living in this denial for very long. In 1930, Frankfurt School director Karl Grunberg suffered a non-fatal heart attack. He retired and was succeeded by Max Horkheimer. And Horkheimer wanted to marshal in a much different approach at the Institute. Instead of taking his predecessor's detached, purely economic method to studying how society works, Horkheimer wanted to actually change society. He'd become skeptical of the orthodox Marxist belief that communism was an inevitable outcome of capitalism. In fact, a few years earlier, he wrote an essay entitled The Impotence of the German Working Class, where he argued that capitalism used prosperity to fool the German workers into complacency. He began developing the viewpoint that by successfully integrating the working class into its economic structure, capitalism stripped the revolutionary energy out of the German working class. Capitalism made them financially comfortable, which in turn pressured them into supporting capitalism to protect the jobs that were providing that comfort. In the eyes of Horkheimer, the German working class had a false consciousness. They weren't awakened to the true suffering that capitalism was imposing on them. As a result, German Marxists were losing their enraged proletariat, the force it needed for communist revolution to erupt in Germany. With the principal doctrine of Marxism now on the ropes, Horkheimer wanted to find another way to ignite a communist revolution in his home country. So he turned the Frankfurt School towards the social sciences to see how German culture influenced the population. He felt that Marxism was too focused on the economy and not seriously exploring other aspects of society. If they could understand how much culture and the economy influenced the German people, they could better devise a way for Marxism to spread throughout their country that had been stubbornly resistant to communist revolution. As the Institute delved into this direction, it attracted arguably its most influential and sinister figure.
In 1933, a man named Herbert Marcuse walked into the Frankfurt School inquiring about a job. A year earlier, Marcuse was studying philosophy at the University of Freiburg in Germany when he came to a realization. With the rise of the Nazi Party, Herbert Marcuse concluded that he'd never qualify as a professor in this new regime. Marcuse was a Jew, so he began to look elsewhere for work and turned to the Frankfurt School. Marcuse had participated in the failed German communist uprising in 1919, so his interests were aligned with the Institute's new direction. He interviewed for a job, and they hired him. This should have been the end of the story. The Frankfurt School would have likely toiled away in obscurity for years, the fruits of their labor collecting dust in some far-off Frankfurt storage room. But that wasn't to be. Before Marcuse could start work at the Institute, the situation in Germany took a dark turn.
Dann tritt für mich ein, so wie ich für dich eingetreten bin.
On January 30, 1933, Adolf Hitler was appointed Chancellor of Germany. A few weeks later, the Nazi swastika flag was raised over Frankfurt Town Hall. Many of the Frankfurt School researchers were Jewish, including its director Max Horkheimer. So they began executing a plan to move the Institute out of Germany. They deposited the school's endowment in Holland, and this move looked prescient. Shortly after Hitler's appointment, the Nazis seized the Institute's building. Horkheimer fled to Geneva. Herbert Marcuse followed. But their stay there was short-lived. A year later, in 1934, the Marxist refugees turned their eyes to America's shores. A member of the Frankfurt School convinced Columbia University in New York to give the Institute refuge. Horkheimer moved their operation to Columbia University. Marcuse and other exiled colleagues followed. And just like that, the future creators of the most poisonous ideology ever foisted on Western civilization were injected into the hallowed halls of academia, an institution that helps define what it means to be American. In other words, what came next could have been avoided.
Welcome back to Red Pilled America. So at the end of World War I, German Marxist intellectuals were stunned that their country's revolution didn't result in a socialist state. To figure out why, they organized a conference to study Marxism, and in 1923, they launched a permanent institute that would come to be known as the Frankfurt School. the Institute would eventually be led by Max Horkheimer, a Marxist that steered its research towards the social sciences. The Institute hired Herbert Marcuse. When Hitler was appointed Chancellor of Germany in 1933, Horkheimer, Marcuse, and other Jewish Frankfurt School colleagues fled, eventually finding refuge at Columbia University's Sociology Department in New York. And just like that, the future creators of the most poisonous ideology ever foisted on Western civilization were injected into the hallowed halls of academia, an institution that helps define what it means to be American. The rise of Nazism in their homeland was a startling event for these Marxist intellectuals. Before Hitler's rise, Marxist doctrine held that there was only one inevitable outcome of capitalism, that being Marxism. But the rise of Hitler showed that capitalism could lead to a second result, fascism. The Frankfurt School's research took on an even more urgent nature. In their eyes, socialism was what would save the world from fascism, so it desperately needed to be revamped for the modern times. Now in America, safe from the iron fist of Hitler, these Marxist intellectuals embarked on Horkheimer's grand vision: to find a way for Marxism to spread into Western societies that had been stubbornly resistant to communist revolution. Ultimately, the Frankfurt School wanted to revamp Marxism to make it an agent of societal change. The seeds of neo-Marxism sprouted. This neo-Marxist outlook is revealed in a 1937 essay by Horkheimer entitled Traditional and Critical Theory. In it, Horkheimer divides the world into two realms. He characterized the first realm as traditional theory, which is a process of understanding the world as it is, the actual witnessed world, how an existing society is structured, and how it actually functions in practice. In the second realm, Horkheimer introduced the seminal idea of critical theory, which is the practice of examining the existing society against an idealized vision of the world, and trying to understand the mechanisms that are holding the existing world back from functioning like the idealized society, with the ultimate goal of shifting culture to this perfected vision of the world. Horkheimer proposed drawing from such diverse fields as economics, sociology, psychology, political science, mass communications, and even geography to help identify the mechanisms holding the existing society back from becoming the idealized version. By default, this critical theory inspired activism, something uncommon in academia at the time. In order to shift culture to the idealized society, one needs to actively remove the corrupting societal barriers and insert parameters that accelerate the change towards the ideal. The problem was that Horkheimer was a Marxist. His idealized society was a socialist state. If capitalism wouldn't inevitably lead the Western world to communism, critical theory would be the new tool to help tip society towards a socialist revolution. Horkheimer's critical theory was Marxism repackaged for the modern world. Historian and philosopher Jonathan Ray noted in a 2010 interview why many believed Horkheimer used the term critical theory to brand his new field of academic work.
Well, he made this contrast between traditional theory and critical theory. And some people say that really he was using the word critical theory because he was a bit too frightened to use the word Marxism.
These German intellectuals were calculated about using words that hid their true intentions. They wanted to appeal to a less radical audience while hiding from the building disdain of Marxism in the Western world. In 1941, Max Horkheimer moved to Los Angeles when the Golden Age of Hollywood was at its peak. Perhaps inspired by this new environment, Horkheimer began to study what he referred to as the mass culture industries of film, radio, music, magazines, and books, and how they influenced Western civilization. The research triggered his next seminal work, and in 1947, he teamed with another Frankfurt School colleague in exile named Theodore Adorno. The two published The Dialectic of Enlightenment, and in it, they expanded on the idea that Karl Marx's later work focused too heavily on material and economic concerns and not enough on how cultural institutions spread ideas. Karl Marx's earlier work explored these areas through his enthusiasm in a German philosopher named Hegel, but Karl Marx would later shed Hegel's ideas in his seminal book Das Kapital. In essence, Horkheimer and his colleague Adorno wanted to put the Hegel back in Marxism. The Dialectic of Enlightenment was the Frankfurt School's clearest statement to date on what critical theory was, and in the process, they embarked on a full-throated attack on Western civilization. They offered that capitalist societies were able to force the working class into conformity through the mass cultural industries of film, radio, magazines, music, books, and the like. And with this insight, they no doubt saw that these cultural industries could also be used as tools to spread Marxism.
While Horkheimer and Adorno were developing critical theory, their colleague Herbert Marcuse was working in Washington, D.C. Marcuse started at FDR's Office of War Information, creating anti-Nazi propaganda. He went on to work for the Office of Strategic Services, the predecessor of the CIA, and then the U.S. Department of State, where he worked as an intelligence analyst of Nazism. If you ever wondered how the deep state could have leftist zealots in their ranks, look no further than the life of Herbert Marcuse. He retired from his State Department position in 1951 after the death of his first wife. Marcuse moved on to teaching his political theories at Columbia University, then Harvard, and eventually landed at Brandeis University in 1954. By 1955, Marcuse was appointed the director of the Frankfurt School, and he published another seminal neo-Marxist book entitled Eros and Civilization. In it, he continued developing the argument that Western society steals the revolutionary energy from the working class and repurposes that energy into productive work that benefits the capitalist system. The Frankfurt School intellectuals were slowly coming to a consensus. Remember, Marxism was historically fueled by the conflict between the bourgeois capitalist and the working class proletariat that they exploited. As long as Marxists could amplify the conflict between the so-called oppressed and oppressor, that energy could be harnessed to spark a communist revolution. But the problem that the Frankfurt School intellectuals had was that 1950s Americans were prospering like never before. The country's young adults had just defeated true evil in Nazi Germany. And with that victory came some clarity. The family is what mattered. It became the cornerstone of the thriving country. Just as this principle was embraced throughout the nation, the television became a staple in homes, pumping the American ideal of the nuclear family into living rooms all across the country.
June, I'm starved.
It's all ready, honey. Did you call the boys?
Will I? Hey, Wally! Beaver! Boys!
TV sitcoms showcased this middle-class American ideal, with the father of the house as the breadwinner and the mother as the caregiver. The working class, the group Marxists counted on to spark communist revolution, was experiencing what every Marxist hated: prosperity. By the late 1950s, the Frankfurt School intellectuals were coalescing around the concrete realization that the working class no longer had the energy needed to trigger their socialist revolution. Their original proletariat was too busy enjoying the fruits of capitalism. And as a result, the working class was incentivized to keep the capitalist system in place that was delivering those fruits. These Marxist intellectuals needed to find their revolutionary energy elsewhere. They were on the hunt for new oppressed revolutionaries. Netflix, Hulu, HBO Max, Disney Plus, Apple TV, Amazon Prime, Showtime, Paramount, Paramount Plus, and on and on. What do these streaming services have in common? They are all storytelling platforms. Which of these platforms are you supporting with your hard-earned money? Now ask yourself if the stories being told on those platforms truly align with your worldview. And if they don't, ask yourself where you go to get entertainment in the form of storytelling that does align with your worldview. Red Pilled America is that show. We are not another talk show covering today's news. We are all about telling stories. 3 years later, we remain the only show of our kind. And why aren't there more shows like ours? Because it's expensive to create this kind of content. That's why we need your support. Without your support, this show doesn't survive. And more importantly, there'll be zero change to the monopolistic environment of storytelling. Please visit redpilledamerica.com and click support in the top menu. Support what you love or it goes away. The choice is yours.
Welcome back to Red Pilled America. So by the late 1950s, the Frankfurt School Marxist intellectuals began to conclude that their working-class proletariat no longer had the disgruntled energy necessary to start their much-desired socialist uprising. They were on the hunt for new oppressed revolutionaries. In 1959, a segment of that new coalition started to reveal itself.
While city officials, state agencies, white liberals, and sober-minded Negroes stand idly by, a group of Negro dissenters is taking to street corner stepladders, church pulpits, sports arenas, and ballroom platforms across the United States to preach a gospel of hate that would set off a federal investigation if it were preached by Southern whites.
On the eve of the 1960s, reporter Mike Wallace introduced America to the black nationalists known as the Nation of Islam.
What are they saying? Listen.
I charge the white man with being the greatest liar on earth. I charge the white man with being the greatest drunkard on earth. I charge the white man with being the greatest gambler on earth. I charge the white man, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, with being the greatest murderer on earth. I charge the white man with being the greatest adulterer on earth. I charge the white man with being the greatest troublemaker on earth. So therefore, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, I ask you, bring back a verdict of guilty as charged.
The indictment you have just heard is being delivered over and over again in most of the major cities across the country. This charge comes at the climax of a morality play called The Trial. The plot, indeed the message of the play, is that the white man has been put on trial for his sins against the black man. He has been found guilty. The sentence is death. The play is sponsored, produced by a Negro religious group who call themselves the Muslims. These homegrown Negro American Muslims are the most powerful of the black supremacist groups.
Mike Wallace then introduced the American public to the spokesman of the Nation of Islam, Malcolm X, and America would never be the same.
Here you will hear Elijah Muhammad introduced by Minister Malcolm X, the Muslims' New York leader and ambassador at large for the movement. The good news that Minister X talks about here is the coming rise of the black man and the fall of the white man.
In the church, we used to sing the song, "Good news, the chariot is coming." But what we must bear in mind, that what's good news to one person is bad news to another.
The good news for the black man is that he is on the verge of recapturing his position as ruler of the universe. The bad news for the white man is that his long and wicked reign will shortly be over.
A reporter asked Malcolm X a few very pointed questions.
Minister Malcolm, you now in Chicago and in Detroit have universities of Islam, do you not?
Yes, sir, in Detroit and Chicago.
And you take your parishioners, you take children from the kindergarten ages, and you train them right through high school.
Yes, sir.
And kids come to your school in lieu of going to what we would call regular day school.
Yes, sir, many.
What do you teach them there?
We teach them the same things that they would be taught ordinarily in school, minus the little black Sambo story and things that were taught to you and me when we were coming up to breed that inferiority complex in us.
Do you teach them what you've just said to me, that the white man is a symbol of evil?
You can go to any little Muslim child and ask him, where's hell or who is the devil? And he wouldn't tell you that hell is down in the ground or that the devil is something invisible that you can't see. He'll tell you hell is right where he has been catching it, and he'll tell you who the one who is responsible for him having received this hell is the devil.
And he would say that this devil is the white man?
Yes.
Can a white man join your temple?
None has ever joined.
If one came up and attempted to join, would he be allowed to come in and be taught?
No, sir.
1959 Americans had never seen anything like Malcolm X on their TV screens. He hit their living rooms like a nuclear bomb. His message was no doubt shocking to most, but resonated with a radical segment of the population that was growing in dark corners of America. A message that sold the idea of victimhood. Malcolm X was the leader of a new school of black activists that were taking a militant approach to addressing their grievances. Their oppressor was the white man, and Malcolm X warned that if the white man did not correct their ship, they would pay a heavy price.
And I, for one, as a Muslim, believe that the white man is intelligent enough, if he were made to realize how black people really feel and how fed up we are without that old compromise and sweet talk, why, you're the one that make it hard for yourself. The white man believes you when you go to him with that old sweet talk, because you've been sweet talking him ever since he brought you here. Stop sweet talking. Tell him how you feel. Tell him how, what kind of hell you've been catching, and let him know that if he's not ready to clean his house up, if he's not ready to clean his house up, he shouldn't have a house. It should catch on fire and burn down.
Malcolm X was revealing a new energy within the black community, a militant rage that viewed the white man depicted on American TV as their oppressor. People could have scoffed off Malcolm X's rhetoric as just the rantings of a minor fringe player, but that perspective changed when a controversial foreign leader came to town that revealed how Malcolm X's group could be attached to a much larger movement. In September 1960, the new Prime Minister of Cuba, Fidel Castro, traveled with a delegation to the UN General Assembly in New York City. It was a year after Fidel successfully orchestrated Cuba's communist revolution. When he and his delegation arrived at the Big Apple's plush Shelburne Hotel, according to Fidel, the hotel asked him for a $10,000 cash advance to cover any damage his entourage might cause to the room. Many critics of the Cuban communists believed he was exaggerating, and that what happened next was a Fidel Castro-orchestrated publicity stunt. As the story goes, Fidel marched to the UN Secretary General and said that his delegation would set up tents in the patio gardens at the UN if the Shelburne Hotel didn't change its tune. Fidel said to reporters, quote, "We are mountain people. We are used to sleeping in the open air," end quote. According to Fidel, news of his housing dilemma made its way to Malcolm X. That's when the black nationalist leader allegedly extended an invitation to Fidel and his delegation to stay at the Teresa in Harlem, a run-down black-owned hotel where New York's African-American politicians often met. "You'll be welcomed with open arms," Malcolm X reportedly said. Fidel Castro would later reflect on his options, stating, quote, "We face two alternatives. One was the United Nations Gardens. When I mentioned this to the Secretary General, he was horrified at the thought of a delegation in tents there. But when we received Malcolm X's offer, he had spoken with one of our comrades. I said, that is the place, the Hotel Teresa. And there we went," end quote. Shortly after Castro's arrival at the Teresa Hotel, the black nationalist leader paid him a visit.
"Malcolm X, he is the leader of the nationalist Negro movement known as the Muslims, and Mr. X early this morning met with Cuba's Fidel Castro here at the Hotel Teresa in New York."
Malcolm X recalled their meeting.
"Monday night, we heard that Fidel Castro was coming to the Teresa, which was unbelievable.
He had a do bill that didn't work at the Shelburne."
"Well, that's what somebody said, but I'm inclined not to go along with everything that I hear. So we went to the Teresa, and when we got there, the place was packed, jammed, right. And there was a lot of confusion and excitement. The police led us through their lines.
Right.
We were led by them up to the ninth floor and into Dr. Castro's room. And he greeted us very cordially. We sat down, and so that was that."
News reports of the time expressed the warm welcome that Fidel Castro received by the black residents of Harlem. They gathered in the hundreds outside the Teresa Hotel throughout the duration of his stay. Fidel had built a reputation among the black activists of Harlem as the bearded communist revolutionary who had desegregated Cuba and gave the middle finger to the racist white imperialists of America. At the end of this trip, Fidel expressed gratitude to his Harlem hosts.
"The people of the United States is good people. Harlem people is wonderful people."
Malcolm X would later reflect on Fidel Castro's time at the Harlem Hotel, stating, quote, "The Teresa is now best known as the place where Fidel Castro went during his UN visit and achieved a psychological coup over the U.S. State Department when it confined him to Manhattan, never dreaming that he'd stay uptown in Harlem and make such an impression among the Negroes," end quote. The This revolutionary energy within part of the black community was something that caught the eye of Frankfurt School intellectuals, especially Herbert Marcuse. Black nationalists like Malcolm X were already adopting some of the rhetoric of the Cuban communist leader. They had the same oppressor, the imperialist white American male. They both spoke of liberation from that oppressor. That rhetoric resonated with black activists in places like Harlem, Detroit, and Watts, California. This was the energy that Herbert Marcuse and the other Frankfurt School Marxists were looking for to replace their working-class proletariat. And there were other Nietzsche movements beginning to reveal their alignment with Marxism.
The early 1960s feminist movement was also displaying a kindred soul with the Frankfurt School Marxists.
The war between the sexes could become an Armageddon if we don't get on with our revolution. But if we do get on with it and we restructure society to make equality really possible, then I think the war between the sexes will end.
The first wave feminists of the early 1900s had aligned with socialists during their suffrage movement. Now, the second wave feminist movement, led by Betty Friedan, were using much of the socialist rhetoric and had the same enemy, white American males.
In my opinion, the other half of the revolution, the other half of women's liberation movement, is the boys in my country and in yours wearing their hair long, you know. And those boys who are wearing their hair long are saying no to that brutal, sadistic, tight-lipped, crew-cut, you know, Prussian, big muscle, you know, Ernest Hemingway, kill bears when there are no bears to kill, and napalm all the children in Vietnam and Cambodia to prove that I'm a man, you know, and be dominant and superior to everyone concerned.
A few years earlier, in his book Eros and Civilization, the Frankfurt School's Herbert Marcuse argued that a sexual liberation was what could solve society's ills. He advocated for a society that removed all sexual boundaries and welcomed sexual promiscuity as a necessary behavior to overturn the oppressive handcuffs of Western civilization. His perverse message resonated with the 1960s youth that were ready to rebel against the American ideal pitched on their childhood TV screens. The Frankfurt School was seeing revolutionary energy bubble up in various enclaves of America. But perhaps the most surprising space where this energy was taking root was on college campuses. Even in the wake of its bombshell hate rants on national TV, the sociology department of UC Berkeley invited the controversial Malcolm X to speak on campus in 1963.
Minister Malcolm, the thing that I thought might be good for starting it off is to talk about one of the most pervasive beliefs in the general society about the Nation of Islam, and that is that it is an organization dedicated to the use of violent means to attain its goals. How true is this, and why do you think it persists in society?
The charge of violence against us actually stems from the guilt complex that exists in the conscious and subconscious minds of most white people in this country. They know that they've been violent in their brutality against Negroes, and they feel that someday the Negro is going to wake up and try and do unto them as they have done unto us.
Malcolm X was arguing that whites were afraid that once blacks were awakened to the oppression imposed by the white man, once they were woke, they'd return the favor. And his message seemed to resonate with the overwhelmingly white UC Berkeley audience. The Frankfurt School intellectuals could see a revolutionary energy building throughout segments of the American public. It could be witnessed in the black community, in the feminist movement, the sexual liberation movement, and now on college campuses. These movements were all agitating separately until a shocking event hit America on November 22, 1963.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
The horrible news was the trigger needed to start a socialist uprising in America. It was as if the revolutionary elements throughout America simultaneously realized that they had an opportunity. To an outsider, these pockets of disgruntled Americans all looked like separate movements. I mean, who could have predicted that radical militant blacks, disgruntled white feminists, and young privileged white liberals could be cobbled together to start a Marxist uprising? But if you were the Frankfurt School's Herbert Marcuse, you saw two things that these seemingly desperate groups had in common. They had one, the energy necessary to spark a socialist revolution, and two, they all adopted the same simple idea, that they were all being oppressed by the white man. Herbert Marcuse saw this common thread, and he used it to thread the needle in his 1964 book, One Dimensional Man. In it, Marcuse argued that capitalist societies whittled down critical thinking by occupying people with consumerism, making man a one-dimensional creature unaware that he is a victim of a domination system. Through Marcuse's lens, this machine of domination no longer required blunt force. Capitalism simply strips man of critical, two-dimensional consciousness by providing man just enough goods to pacify him while convincing him, through various forms of mass media, that he is freer than he actually is. Through this process of domination, the individual has no idea how bad they have it. To overcome their victimhood, Marcuse argued that one has to have an awakening to the system of domination. In other words, they have to go woke. At the close of the book, Marcuse concedes that there is a slight chance that the revolutionary movement can be cobbled together from disgruntled racial minorities, feminists, disgruntled sexual minorities, the outcasts of society, and an enlightened intelligentsia that could mark the beginning of the end of this capitalist domination. Marcuse thought their opposition to the system of oppression was revolutionary even if their consciousness was not. He held on to the hope that if they woke up to their true oppression, a real socialist revolution could be realized. Marcuse released One Dimensional Man in 1964, and it captured the spirit of the times. In July 1964, riots erupted in Harlem, the same borough that enthusiastically hosted Fidel Castro just 4 years earlier.
Please do harm and protect the dignity of our Harlem community.
Rioters chanted for Malcolm X.
Over the next few years, riots erupted in almost every black urban city in the country. They went down in Rochester, Newark, Detroit, Philadelphia, Watts, Chicago, Atlanta, Boston, Tampa, Minneapolis, Milwaukee, and many other cities. The media branded them the ghetto riots. Some locals believed agitators helped spark the violence.
Here we have the fools running around, destroying property. This particular person objects. I am colored. We want leaders to lead the people to work, get work for them, find work, educate the children, but not to have them running around, acting like crazy people. And then those who agitate them stands in their homes and laugh.
But it was a protest on the campus of UC Berkeley, the same university that hosted Malcolm X, that inadvertently signaled the dark alliance that was forming.
We're asking that there be no restrictions on the content of speech, save those provided by the courts.
The UC Berkeley protest was branded as the beginning of the free speech movement, but it was false advertising. These students had an ulterior motive. They, along with the riot agitators, were aligned with the Frankfurt School's Marxist teachings, and they were about to ignite a socialist uprising that created the woke culture that plagues America to this day. Next time on Red Pilled America.
Violence is, and will always be, necessary.
We have to talk about a complete and total change in the structures of this society.
This afternoon, we want to talk about the ballot or the bullet.
I believe that the fight is just beginning to start.
Red Pilled America is an iHeartRadio original podcast. It's produced by me, Adriana Cortez, and Patrick Carelci for Inform Ventures. Now, our entire archive of episodes is only available to our Backstage subscribers. To subscribe, visit redpilledamerica.com and click support in the top menu. Thanks for listening.